This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
An Bord erwarten Sie Bars, Spa-Duschen sowie preisgekrönte Bordunterhaltung. Es ist also kein Wunder, dass Emirates als beste Fluggesellschaft der Welt ausgezeichnet wurde. Wir fliegen Sie zu über 140 Reisezielen. Und mit unseren Interline-Partnern weltweit bieten wir Ihnen Anschlussflüge zu weiteren 1700 Städten auf 6 Kontinenten. Wenn wir behaupten, dass wir eine der größten internationalen Fluggesellschaften sind, meinen wir, wir bringen Sie an Ihr Wunschziel. Jetzt buchen auf emirates.de. Fly Emirates, fly better.
We begin today's story in a car in Harlem. Two eyes trace a once familiar landscape. It's been 25 years since Edwin Eddie Ellis has walked these streets. As he steps onto the sidewalk, the sounds of hip-hop and local children playing fills the air, a stark contrast to the prison yard he's just left behind. He wonders how many of those children would also go on to spend decades locked in behind a barred door. Because for the past few years, Eddie has been conducting an investigation in prison, unlike any that had been done before. And it was time to take his findings to the public. I'm Hannah Fry, a mathematician who studies patterns in human behaviour. This is Uncharted, Tales of Data and Discovery. A few years later, a researcher in Brooklyn named Eric Cadora is working for the Centre for Alternative Sentencing and Employment. Their aim was to find ways to deal with crime that didn't just send people to state prison. Settling down with a cigarette, Eric is skipping through news reports, trying to find something useful. An interview from the New York Times catches his eye. It was from 1992 and detailed the recent release of an activist named...
His name was Eddie Ellis. He was actually the former director of communications for the Black Panther Party.
Black people, we are organizing to stop racism. You dig it? That's what we're
going to
stop. What's being done to us?
You can jail a revolutionary, but you can't jail a revolution.
To educate the people in the community. To educate the people everywhere what we want, what we design, what we need.
I am a revolutionary, and you're going to have to keep on saying that.
The controversial Black Panther Party had been founded in Oakland, California. They had a 10-point program of demands which they were prepared to use violence to enact. Universal healthcare, housing and education for the poorest Black Americans. But the Federal Bureau of Investigation saw the Panthers as a dangerous organization. Members faced constant police surveillance and Eddie Ellis, who was helping to form a new local chapter of the Black Panthers in Harlem, got caught up in a counterintelligence program designed to break the Panthers apart. In 1970, Eddie was sentenced to 25 years for the murder of a stranger in an apparent case of mistaken identity. Eddie was the man who, while incarcerated at Green Haven Correctional Facility, had successfully lobbied for college programs to be made available to inmates and persuaded the warden to house those studying together in one wing. He'd also shown a keen interest in getting to know his fellow inmates.
He starts asking questions. What neighborhoods did they come from before being incarcerated in New York State prison?
Eric was intrigued.
Really, the vast majority came from 7 neighborhoods across the city. So that really got me going because we were faced at the time with this polemic problem that dominated the discourse in politics.
New York is almost broke. Sometimes you get mugged during the daylight.
I can remember when public transportation was one of the prides of New York. What happened?
In the 1970s, American cities were in decline. Energy crises produced blackouts. Buildings seemed to be crumbling on street corners. Inflation was high and unemployment was higher. Crime of all kinds was on the rise. But there was one that appeared to require special attention.
America's public enemy number one, drug abuse.
Heroin had flooded in from South America and swept through the counterculture, from the soldiers in Vietnam into the heart of cities all over the country. The American public wanted a hardline approach to the problem.
the country had turned to using more and more and more law enforcement to deal with crime.
But by the 1980s, the narcotics trade had evolved in reaction. According to Ronald Reagan, it was getting worse.
Many of you have written to me how afraid you are to walk the streets alone at night. It's time to get these hardened criminals off the street.
We intend to do what is necessary to end the drug menace and cripple organized crime.
Until that point, the war on drugs was a relatively small component of federal law enforcement efforts, but Reagan was going to change things.
Oh, radical. Radical changes in policing practices, radical lengthening of sentences for the same crimes. Incarceration rates in the United States were flat for over 100 years until the 1980s. And then they skyrocketed out of this world.
Eric Cadora blinked away from the New York Times article. That impromptu survey by Eddie Ellis had discovered that in a population of 1,800 prisoners, three quarters of them had come from just seven neighbourhoods across New York. What if Eric could replicate this informal study on a much bigger scale?
I started to ask for data from the State Department of Corrections in New York. And once I said, you know, by the way, will you just add the home street address of everyone admitted to prison from around the state in a year and everyone released from prison around the state in a year?
Now, these days, the State Department of Corrections in New York might think twice about giving out this sort of data. But this was back in the 1990s.
And they said, sure.
Settling down with a fresh pack of cigarettes, Eric opens a spreadsheet. Several neat columns appeared, detailing hundreds of names. These were individual prisoners from all over New York State. He could see the prison they were in, the crime they'd committed, and critically, the home addresses they'd come from.
One of my mentors, his father was a Baptist minister, and I would go to conferences with him, and he would speak before me. And holy moly, speaking after him was literally like speaking after a Baptist minister. You have no chance. So I started to use pictures and I used maps. I became very familiar with something new to us called hotspot crime mapping.
Hotspot mapping had been brought into the NYPD just a few years earlier and had revolutionized policing across the city. It was part of a new system which could highlight areas where crimes were more prevalent and could help police make proactive decisions about where to focus their resources. In later years, this system would be hailed as both a hero and a villain. Overall, crime rates would decrease across the city, but there would also be a surge in complaints from the public, particularly those in poorer neighbourhoods who felt that the maps gave police the justification to harass them. There were accusations of over-policing and brutality, and officers would later admit that this system and its performance metrics had indeed encouraged unnecessary arrests. But in 1999, this system was still relatively new, and it had given Eric an idea.
What would a map look like if we didn't map crime, but rather we mapped where people live to go in and out of prisons and jail?
It started with a map showing each building that makes up the city of New York and its 339 distinct neighbourhoods. If incarceration was completely random, then when mapped, the home addresses of each prisoner would be spread out evenly across the entire metropolis. But Eric suspected he'd find something else, perhaps clusters that would glow red just like the hotspots of a crime map. As the names are fed into the program, almost immediately, a pattern comes into view.
And now you saw a shocking portrayal. I saw the same home addresses numerous times. And when you aggregated this up to sort of neighborhoods, the concentration of people who go to the state prisons are living in very particular neighborhoods in New York City.
That impromptu survey done by Eddie Ellis all those years ago, it had been right. The residential buildings on just 11 streets in Brooklyn are all glowing bright red. And there was more. Eric could see clearly now that 8.5% of all of the incarcerated residents of Brooklyn came from just one district. District 16, a single block nestled between two parallel streets in the New York grid. The inmates hadn't all ended up in the same prison. Zoom out and Eric could see a web of thin lines starting in those 11 Brooklyn blocks and zigzagging across the entire United States.
What the maps really showed was mass emigration and immigration of mainly parenting-aged men, working-aged men. And when we looked at the rates, not only per neighborhood, but per adult men, it was quite absurd, quite amazing.
Eric now had a map of the entire system, a huge network of red threads linking major cities with the small towns housing the largest state prisons in the country. And it reflected what researchers, justice advocates, and residents had known for decades.
What really was happening was those particular neighborhoods were being governed in very different ways than the rest of the city. Highly disproportionate use of emergency room healthcare, zero tolerance schooling, shelter housing, emergency last resort responses, which had become everyday ways of doing business in those neighborhoods.
These maps weren't just abstract representations. They were stories about people. They represented the emptying out of entire communities, red glimpses into the lives of individuals caught in the gears of a broken system, one that was relying almost entirely on prisons to punish and rarely to rehabilitate.
These maps, they look like something akin to human experience. They really have a power of their own.
Eric and his colleagues desperately wanted to make a difference, but to have their findings heard, they'd have to translate them into something politicians could understand.
We just looked at one part of New York City, the city of Brooklyn. We found 35 individual city blocks for which the state was spending more than $1 million every year to remove and return people, to rent prison cells.
The sums of money are astonishing. To some, this was an extraordinary waste of government funds. Others, they questioned the difference that could be made both to the local community and the city more widely if just a tiny fraction of that sum had been spent on intervention projects or investments in the neighbourhoods that really needed it instead. Across ideological divides, voices began to unite in recognition of the need for change.
Mass incarceration makes our country worse off.
From unlikely corners of the political spectrum, calls for reform echoed, signalling a shift in public consciousness, with maps being a rallying cry for justice. And as for Eddie Ellis, he dedicated his life to alternative justice initiatives. He died in 2014, aged 72, knowing that his idea, an informal survey from 30 years ago, had helped to spark a movement in genuine prison reform.
Next on Uncharted for Discovery, an ambitious portfolio manager discovers a perfect graph outlining eye-watering profits, but something doesn't seem right.
It's October 2005, in a sterile office in Boston, and a young, inexperienced legal clerk is staring down at the title of a report. It reads, "The world's largest hedge fund is a fraud." Our clerk works at the Securities and Exchange Commission, but there is something odd about this one. There's outrageous accusations, not uncommon, but the desperate plea for help and mathematical data catch his eye. If true, this report would point to the impossible. His tired eyes stop on something new, a single simple graph. Shooting from left to right across the X and Y axes are two lines. One line charts the movements of the S&P 500 stock index over time. It's a line that traces the ups and downs of America's corporate giants, a line that is jagged and unstable, littered with sudden hikes and quick dives, just as it should be. The second line, though, far from uneven, it is beautifully smooth. This was the recorded growth of a hedge fund. Could this difference be possible? Could a hedge fund simply expand with little interruption for 15 years? Maybe this was evidence, as the author was suggesting, of a seismic fraud. The clerk hesitates. He's anxious. Threaded through this document is a name, one that comes up over and over again. And there is just no way that this person is a crook. The clerk sighs and throws the report onto his desk. I'm Hannah Fry, a mathematician who studies patterns in human behaviour. This is Uncharted, Tales of Data and Discovery. To understand all of this, we need to travel back 9 years to the spring of 1996. Back then, Frank Casey was a risk analyst. It was his job to spot good investments and persuade people with money that he knew what he was doing. His usual clients were giant pension funds, but Frank had ambitions to get a more exclusive clientele.
So I started speaking with someone that ran an operation out of Europe. He says, and I'll be honest with you, I'm royalty. I know all the royals in Europe. And so I'm saying, okay, fine. What is it?
The answer was predictable. On an upfront investment of, say, 100 million, they want to make a profit using a smart strategy that offers a high return with minimal risk.
So I say, hey, if I can design a system that competes with that, would you give me some of your money?
This royal says something else.
He's hired one guy that's really unique. I said, well, how much are you running with this guy? He says $320 million in the spring of 99.
That is a lot of cash to invest with one person.
He says, well, yes, I have this manager, but I can't tell you who it is. This manager uses options and stocks. This guy gets into the market the day before the market goes up, and he gets out of the market the day before the market goes down. And I said, well, wait a minute. How much is he producing for you? And he says 1% a month, like clockwork.
1% a month, like clockwork. That is a cool $38 million a year. And that initial injection of cash would be safe even if the stock market crashed. Frank was fizzing with curiosity. A secret manager who buys stock before a market surge and then sells it just before it plummets. Whoever they are either a genius or a crook.
And so I'm thinking maybe he's doing some things where he knows that the big banks are going to trade XYZ stock. So he maybe jumps ahead and gets it for his own clients.
This is called front running. It involves exploiting advanced knowledge of pending orders to gain a competitive advantage. And most of the time it is illegal. But if this is what they were doing, that 1% return was still remarkable. In October 1999, a clue drops into Frank's lap.
There was a wealthy family out of the Carolinas. We're sitting in the lobby at the Swiss Hotel down in New York. And they said, well, here's the prospectus that we've designed. I immediately go to the addendums on the back.
Frank spots extraordinary revenue streams and monthly profits going back years. This prospectus belongs to the secret manager.
This family office, I don't know if they've got a billion in it or half a billion. They wouldn't tell me. But I say, may I have this prospectus? Well, sure. Go ahead, but don't show it to anybody.
Frank couldn't believe his luck. This was everything he'd need to form a dream investment product of his own, a rival that could knock this guy out of the park.
Math is truth. If you don't have math, where's the truth going to come from?
Harry Markopoulos did not deal in dreams, but in reality and mathematical proofs. He was in charge of modelling, testing and building the products that people like Frank would think up.
We have to reverse engineer what this guy's doing. And Harry, being the financial whiz that he is, says, it's going to take me about 4 or 5 hours.
Harry ran model after model and tried to replicate a careful balance of market knowledge, risk and reward that would yield 1% profit month to month. But he was coming up against a problem.
They wanted me to duplicate the strategy, but change it somewhat to make it higher returns with higher volatility. So I spent a few hours modeling the returns, and I was able to do that. Unfortunately, you could actually lose up to 48% in 1 month.
No matter what he did, there would always be a loss if the stock market shifted. But Harry ploughed on until finally a breakthrough. There was a way to do it after all.
But when we get caught, we should probably flee the country.
Harry's team looks bemused. They think he's joking, but Harry is not laughing.
They said no, and they're telling me that this guy is a better mathematician. I took pride in my math, which made me infuriated.
And he looks at me, he says, Frank, come on, you're an options expert. It's a fraud at the least. It is probably a Ponzi scheme. And I go, oh, no. Harry, don't call this guy a Ponzi. You and I will be out of business. We'll be fired. I mean, we'll be on the street.
If this was a Ponzi scheme where investors would be paid in fake profits funded by new clients, this operation would be huge. This guy, whoever he was, had to be a big fish. They started to ask around at gala dinners and conference halls, sprinkling in innocent-seeming questions to unsuspecting colleagues, gathering a list of names and numbers. One by one, they would add each name and the total assets invested into a simple spreadsheet. In a short time, the combined figure was staggering. This secret manager had pooled up to $1 billion. And in 2002, things were getting bigger still because the secret manager's clients were cropping up everywhere.
I was very fearful about some of the conduits that I was uncovering. It's much bigger than the United States, and this is going to get dangerous.
But it wasn't until I got to Switzerland. It was a dirty money crowd in Switzerland, and I looked across the next table, and having lunch beside us was a wanted felon in the United States of America. I realized that a lot of that money came from the Russians and from the Latin American drug cartels, some of the most dangerous people on the planet.
I never told my wife, I never told anyone of what I was doing. If my name gets out and I get tied to this guy, there are going to be repercussions.
It felt like things were reaching a tipping point, but they couldn't walk away because the information kept coming. By 2005, the combined total on the bottom of that spreadsheet was now truly breathtaking.
This guy, he has grown from $5 billion to over $50 billion. The world's largest hedge fund is a fraud.
Frank and Harry had uncovered a piece of information that would finally prove it to the world, too.
It was probably the simplest math proof of the entire case. There were not enough options in the world for him to be conducting his trading strategy as he stated to investors. He needed anywhere between $3 to $64.8 billion of a certain type of option. And unfortunately for him, there was never more than 1.5 billion of those options in existence.
But eye-watering sums of money had been collected, and Harry and Frank realized this scheme was a ticking time bomb, which wouldn't just affect the super rich. It would touch normal people across the world who had entrusted their income, their pensions, and their life savings to a criminal.
This guy was a punk to me, and I just wanted to take him down.
So, on a cold day in October 2005, Harry sits down to write a 25-page dossier containing a detailed account of 29 red flags and a single graph. He sends it to the Security and Exchange Commission, and it reaches the desk of a hapless legal clerk, because this was not the first time he had warned them. Harry had alerted the SEC to the hedge fund and its secret manager in the year 2000, in 2001, and now in 2005. But after a series of short reviews, the SEC failed to take action. Harry would go on to file the same complaints yet again in 2007 and again in 2008.
No one believed us. No one cared about the math.
But then, something happened.
Lehman Brothers is going bankrupt, and financial markets from Asia to Europe are doing their utmost to prevent Monday from turning from dark to black.
During the crash of 2008, investment funds all over the world began to fall apart. Too many people were wanting their money back. And there was one man who had guaranteed investments would be safe no matter what. The banks, hedge fund managers, and individual investors raced to him first. On December the 10th, 2008, the Wall Street giant Bernie Madoff confessed to his employed family members, his younger brother and two sons, that his investment advisory business was a fraud.
I had two messages, and it said, "Harry, congratulations, you were right. Madoff turned himself in. He's under arrest in New York."
Harry is screaming into my cell phone. We had him. And then it started coming out.
Overnight, the lives of hundreds of clients, including charities, synagogues, families, even his own friends, had been destroyed.
I picked up the phone and I said, "Abe, you sound distraught." He says, "We just lost everything." And I put down that phone and I had fists of rage that he would destroy an individual like that.
People lost their homes. Thousands of lives were ruined. There were dozens of suicides.
On June the 29th, 2009, Bernie Madoff was sentenced to over 150 years in prison and ordered to pay back $170 billion in restitution. He died in prison on the 14th of April, 2021. Attempts to recover the funds are ongoing. The SEC had failed to do its job. How could they have missed this? In 2009, they were hauled into Congress, and it was here that Harry Markopoulos was finally able to lay bare this story and the problem at the heart of it all.
They had too many lawyers and not enough accountants. Math will never lie. It will reveal truth.
An Bord erwarten Sie Bars, Spa-Duschen sowie preisgekrönte Bordunterhaltung. Es ist also kein Wunder, dass Emirates als beste Fluggesellschaft der Welt ausgezeichnet wurde. Wir fliegen Sie zu über 140 Reisezielen. Und mit unseren Interline-Partnern weltweit bieten wir Ihnen Anschlussflüge zu weiteren 1700 Städten auf 6 Kontinenten. Wenn wir behaupten, dass wir eine der größten internationalen Fluggesellschaften sind, meinen wir, wir bringen Sie an Ihr Wunschziel. Jetzt buchen auf emirates.de. Fly Emirates. Fly better.